I'd like now to welcome to the program Paul Bauer. He is Principal Geologist at New Mexico Bureau of Geology and Mineral Resources at New Mexico Tech. He's author of the award-winning book, The Rio Grande. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So you are a geologist, which I imagine really colors the way that you see landscape around you. Would you like to give us a little history of the Rio Grande in geological time terms? Like, what was there before, and how did this river come into being?
Wow, that's a serious question.
Yeah.
The Rio Grande has a history that's tens of millions of years old. And really, the modern river that we see today that stretches from the San Juans down to the Gulf of Mexico is a fairly modern river system.
Meaning it's in the millions of years old? Or
even less than that. But the foundation for building that river system started about 30 million years ago when the Rio Grande Rift developed. So the crust of the earth split from Mexico all the way up into Colorado, split apart, made a valley, and through time, through all kinds of different changes, volcanoes, earthquakes, all kinds of things, have conspired to create the modern river we see now, which is really only about 300,000 years old.
Ah, okay. Now, there's some maps or diagrams of what was there before in geological time, and I have a hard time thinking in time scales like that, but there was a gigantic lake in Colorado near Alamosa where the river is now.
Yeah, that entire Alamosa Valley, probably for several million years, was a lake that was about 150 miles long and 150 feet deep. It was in existence during the time that the glaciers were here and gone. So there were glacier and interglacial periods, times that were wet and less wet, warm and cold. And so that lake just kind of, it just grew, and then it would shrink, and it grew and shrink. And then one time, about 300,000 years ago, it grew deep enough to actually spill over the volcanic dam on the south end. And at that point, the lake drained into the Rio Grande Canyon, and the river that we know now started to evolve. That was the start of it.
Now, you write that New Mexico is called the volcano state. Do we really have an especially large number of volcanoes here?
We do. We have not only a large number, but a variety of types of volcanoes. We have little cinder cones like Capulin Mountain over in northeastern New Mexico that you can drive to the top of. And we have huge explosive supervolcanoes like the Jemez. So we truly are the volcano state.
How many of those volcanoes, if any, are active?
So none of New Mexico's volcanoes are currently active. The youngest volcanoes in the state are in the orders of thousands of years old. There are some young flows out by the Malpais, out by Grants. And then Valley of Fire is down by Tularosa. Two of the youngest volcanic flows in the state. The Jemez, though, the big supervolcano, the last time it was active in a big way was just a little over a million years ago.
How geologically active are we in general? Is this also an earthquake state?
So this is a terrifically active state, and it's mostly because the Rio Grande Rift, this young crack in the earth, is still active. It's still spreading. The basins where the river runs is still dropping. There continue to be earthquakes along the rift itself.
Now, tell us about rifts. Is this a tectonic plate kind of thing, or how does the earth just crack open from Mexico to Colorado?
So this is not the edge of a plate. It's well into the interior of a continental plate. But what's happened is that things that have happened 1,000 miles to the west along the Pacific coast have created conditions that resulted in the crust cracking here through Colorado and New Mexico. And it has to do, yes, with plate tectonics over there on the coast, California coast.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the Rio Grande. We're talking to Paul Bauer, geologist, whose book is called Rio Grande, A River Guide to the Geology and Landscapes of Northern New Mexico. Where does the water come from? How is it fed, and what are the river's sources of water along the way?
The Rio Grande, the headwaters technically are up in the San Juan Mountains of Colorado, but it's an interesting river because most of the recharge, the big watershed, is in two separate mountain ranges, partly over in the San Juan Mountains of Colorado in northern New Mexico, and partly in the Sangre de Cristos, so the Taos side. And the river runs down between those two mountain ranges.
So is that unusual for a river to have multiple watersheds like that?
It can be, yeah. It's great for the Rio Grande because it means that, let's say, there's not a very good snowpack in Colorado and the San Juans, but a great snowpack on the Sangre de Cristos, there could be some pretty good water for rafting and other things like agriculture in the river. So having two mountain ranges is kind of a nice safety valve for the river.
Right, right. And yet, there are still a lot of drains on the Rio Grande's water.
Yeah. Taos County is basically the recharge zone. So most of the water that enters the Rio Grande is from those mountains. Once you get past Taos County, then river depletions really can begin.
And what kind of depletions? Who and for what? Who's draining the river of water along its course?
Well, there are a variety of entities that use water. Obviously, all the cities. Santa Fe now has a direct diversion on the river, the Buckman direct diversion. Takes river water and filters it and uses it. Albuquerque has a similar setup. But the greater proportion of water diverted from the Rio Grande is used for agriculture in the middle Rio Grande Valley.
Right.
And then we're obligated to send a certain amount to Texas each year.
Right, right. Now, by the time it gets down to its end into the Gulf of Mexico, how much river do we have?
Well, the Rio Grande is also fascinating because it's an exotic river, and that's actually a technical term. It means that most of its recharge happens in its headwaters. It, between Taos County and El Paso, there's hardly any recharge to that river. And so the exotic terminology means through most of its course, there's not enough precipitation to keep water in the river.
Right.
And so it really depends on the water year. If there's a lot of water moving down through the system and the reservoirs are full, then water can make it down along the Texas-Mexico border. There's a big river down there that comes in from Mexico, so that's the first big recharge source below New Mexico. And so in good years, water will get to the Gulf, but in the early 2000s, I believe, was a year where no water got to the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, my goodness. Did you see that? Did you witness it? I wonder what it looked like.
I didn't see it. I guess it was just a dry river. There are stretches in New Mexico, in central New Mexico, near where I live in Socorro, that periodically dry up in dry summers.
Right. Now, to what extent is there protection on the river?
So the part of the river that's covered in this book, most of that has protection under the Wild and Scenic River Act.
And what's that?
It's a congressional designation that provides certain safeguards for the river and the river corridor. Certain kinds of development can't occur along there. There are aspects having to do with visual, so people on the river or walking along the river, there are certain types of visual effects that are not permitted.
Right. And the purpose of it, well, what is the purpose of it? Is it to protect it for recreation? Is it protect species? Protect the water itself?
All of the above. That act is fairly broad for protecting all kinds of things including scientific values.
Now, you are a boater. You like to go out on boats and rafts and all kinds of things on the river, and this book that you wrote is really a river guide, and it's for people who presumably also like to get on the water. How did you get into this whole, I guess you would call it, recreational activity?
Well, I was a geologist first. I was a grad student at UNM in 1980, and I was invited on a Taos Box trip. There was a lot of water in the river that year.
What's the Taos Box?
So the Taos Box is a very exciting stretch of Class 3 and Class 4 water. So very fun, very energetic rapids.
I always wondered about that term box, because box is such a Cartesian thing, and the river is so wild.
Yeah, and I think the box has to do with the shape of the canyon.
Is it really that square-ish?
Deep and steep-sided, yeah.
So you went on a box river trip.
With some friends, took a Taos box trip from one of the outfitters. Those were the early days for the outfitters on the Rio Grande. There were several companies that were just starting out their first few years. And it was a blast. We had a great time. Through a curious set of circumstances, I ended up starting a PhD study up there in the Picaris Mountains, which are right along the Rio Grande there in Taos County. And I was living up there and spending a lot of time there studying the geology. And so after a certain amount of time, the whitewater recreation and the geology kind of intersected, merged. I was asked to teach geology to the river guides at this annual spring event they have called the Rio Grande Rendezvous. And one thing led to another. I realized there's lots of misinformation about the geology.
Oh, really? Like what?
Yeah. Well, for example, up there near Taos, the Rio Grande Rift, so the big crustal feature, is about 20 miles across. It's that wide. So it's from mountain range to mountain range across the valley. The Rio Grande Gorge is only a few hundred yards. It's maybe a quarter mile wide. And there were lots of people who thought that gorge was actually the rift. They're very different features. The rift is much older. The gorge is simply erosion from the river. And so there was that kind of information going around, and I realized that there was a need for an educational book that merged geology with the whitewater experience.
Now, it's important for whitewater or river guides in general to have correct information about this, just so that they're not spreading wrong information to their many clients and guests and so on. Does it also make you a better river guide if you know the geology?
I think it does, absolutely. And there are different aspects to being a good river guide. One is just the technical skill, right? Let's get down the river safely. And another is you're in a boat with people who, you know, have paid for this trip. Part of your job as a river guide is to teach them. You could even use the word entertain them. About the natural setting, about what they're seeing as they journey down the rivers. And so what do you see? Mostly what you see on rivers is geology. There's wildlife and botany and other aspects too, but most of it's geology. So a river guide who knows his or her geology, I think, can put on a better trip for their customers. And in lots of cases, that can translate to better tips for the guides, too.
Right.
So they're pretty enthusiastic for good information.
Now, what kind of boats do you like to use when you go on the river?
Oh, I have a few different kinds, depending on what the trip is. If it's with people or with dogs.
You take dogs on the river?
Absolutely.
Really?
Sure.
Do they fall in?
Not too often. But they do wear life jackets, just like the
goodness.
People. Yeah. And
even like little dogs?
Little dogs. I have a little dog who goes rafting.
Nice.
Yeah. And
So if you take dogs, you're going to take them on a raft and not a kayak or a canoe or something.
Yeah, or other people going along, or if it's an overnight trip and you have stuff, you know, food and coolers and stoves, then you'd want to take a raft. If you're just going out for the day and want to have some fun, you can take an inflatable kayak. It's also called a funyak, which is really fun because you have your own little boat, your own paddle, and so you're in control.
You hope.
You hope. You can go where you want, and you can run in really low water, like now. Right now, it's low up there on some of those stretches, and so most of the commercial trips are in these funyaks.
Now, how much does the level of the water vary from one part of the year to another, one season to another?
Yeah, so the water, in general, the water in any year follows a pattern that could start with snow melt early in the spring, which typically has peaked in late May. This year, there were some perturbations in the climate, apparently, and the peak was much earlier. It was 4 or 5 weeks earlier. That peak is usually followed by a slow decline in the level of the river. And then at some point, the irrigation in Colorado kicks in. So they start diverting a lot of the Rio Grande, you know, into the fields for alfalfa and potatoes, etc. And so the river can drop pretty low at that point.
Do we have records of how it ran before all that agricultural diversion, or is that diversion just so old that we don't know what it was like before?
That's a really good question. We have the oldest gauging station in the country up there on the Rio Grande at near Embudo. And John Wesley Powell, famous Grand Canyon explorer, was head of the U.S. Geological Survey in 1888, and he decided that the nation needed to be able to tell how much water was in the rivers. And so he set up the first gauging station there at Embudo. And at that point, the engineers taught themselves basically how to measure a flow in a river, which is more complicated than one might think. And so in that one spot, we have a record for the Rio Grande that goes back to 1889, which is a long time.
Indeed.
Yeah. But there was development in Colorado around that time. So it wasn't total baseline before any development upstream, but most of it.
Now, what are your favorite parts of the river?
Wow, what are my favorite parts of the river?
As a boater, not as a geologist.
So as a boater, I can't name just one. I love some of the upper parts up at southern Colorado, northernmost New Mexico. They are places where you actually have to carry your stuff in and out. But there's a stretch up there that goes past the state line called Ute Mountain Run, which is beautiful and isolated and very seldom visited by people other than anglers, people that are fishing, that have walked in. And it's a very nice stretch. Not all that thrilling. I also like the thrilling parts, such as the Taos Box.
Meaning a lot of rapids?
Rapids,
that kind of thrilling?
Yeah, lots of excitement, lots of things you have to do as a boater to move, you know, down the river safely, whether your paddle or your oars.
What kind of mistakes do people make? I mean, where do they get into trouble?
People can get into all kinds of trouble. It's generally a really safe sport. People can get into trouble by not having the proper equipment. They can get into trouble by overestimating their abilities and skills for navigating whitewater. They can get into trouble for reasons that are totally beyond their control. Something happened, there's maybe a new rapid, maybe a tree has fallen into the river, things that could be unexpected.
Now, do you see, we're talking, by the way, to Paul Bauer about his book, The Rio Grande, A River Guide to the Geology and Landscapes of Northern New Mexico. Do you see changes in the level of the river or other manifestations that look like they're due to human-caused climate change?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not a climate scientist, but I am a student of this part of the Rio Grande. I guess from what I know about what the climate scientists are saying about the changes that have already begun and that will continue and probably accelerate, one of the major changes is that the snowpack will melt faster and earlier.
And well, you said that there was an earlier peak this year, this past year. Is that for that reason?
Well, that's what happened this year is exactly what the models predict and what the climate scientists have been saying. What happened is there was a fair amount of snow in the mountains this year, and it started melting early, and it melted fairly fast. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's the new norm. You know, if we're going to see lots more of that in the future, and other kind of extreme events, you know, including big rain events and big drought events in the Rio Grande watershed.
Now, there is a geologic timetable in the back of your book, and at the top there is a modern mass extinction of 4,000 species per year. What does that mean for the Rio Grande?
So, from a geologist's perspective, mass extinction events are not uncommon in the geologic record. Normally, these events take quite a bit of time. They have to do with gradual climate change on large scale. What's happening now across the Earth with the loss of biodiversity is on a different time scale. So what's happening now on the orders of tens of years or hundreds of years, used to, in the past, extinctions would take, you know, hundreds to thousands or tens of thousands of years. So the extinction event that's occurring now could easily end up being one of the largest in Earth history.
Paul Bauer is Principal Geologist at New Mexico Bureau of Geology and Mineral Resources at New Mexico Tech. Paul Bauer, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the invitation.